Oh, how great are God's riches and wisdom and knowledge. Welcome, everyone. I'm McDaniel Phillips, and this is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. And our host is author, teacher, and itinerant speaker, Kenneth Wong. Well, today, Ken begins a series on one of my most favorite portions of the Old Testament. And although God's name is not mentioned throughout the entire book of Esther, his sovereignty is unmistakable. And so the Apostle Paul proclaims to the church in Rome, "Oh, how great are God's riches and wisdom and knowledge! How impossible it is for us to understand his decisions and his ways." In just a moment, Ken presents to us part one of The Sovereign Hand of God.
Hello, everyone. I trust you have had a good weekend, and welcome back to Times of Refreshing as we start a most fascinating study of the book of Esther in the Old Testament. This is a Bible book that makes for a most fascinating reading. It's full of intrigue and conspiracy. There is suspense and surprise. In fact, some people might think of it as the perfect material for a bestseller book or a box office hit movie or even a blockbuster TV serial. But this is not a fairy tale. It's a historical happening that is recorded in the Bible. So if you've been finding your Bible reading just a little bit dry and doctrinal maybe for this time, I would suggest that you try reading this book for a change. The major theme of this book is God's hand versus human hands at work behind the scenes. By bringing us behind the scenes, as it were, and seeing things from God's perspective, we can see God's invisible and unseen but sovereign and providential hand at work for those who love him and know him, which is what the Apostle Paul says in the well-loved verse of Romans 8:28, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose." And we see this wonderfully demonstrated not just once, but time and again throughout the book of Esther. And so I have entitled this series of studies on the book of Esther, "The Sovereign Hand," which is, of course, unmistakably the sovereign hand of God. And we see God's providential and sovereign hand unmistakably manifested throughout the book, even though God is amazingly never named or mentioned or even referred to directly in the whole book. And that can be how it is in life for those who do not know God. Things may seem to happen by chance, by coincidence, or in apparent randomness, when all the time God is in full control. We're going to open our studies by considering three settings, and the right place to begin would be from God's perspective, and we shall call this the providential setting. And secondly, it's the political setting, and that is from man's perspective. And thirdly, it's the personal setting, and that's from Esther's personal perspective as the key character in this whole book, after whom it is named. So let's first look at the providential setting. This is a powerful portrayal of what is sometimes called providence. That means it's God's provision according to his purpose. We see the sovereign hand of God weaving a wonderful tapestry in history. As is sometimes put, history is really his story. Men may seem to rule, but God overrules. God is really the one in absolute control. He's the one who oversees, overrules, and overturns the affairs of men, whenever and wherever he so chooses. Sometimes he does it in ways that are past finding out. They are inscrutable to us. As it says in Romans 11:33, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out." That's a very apt commentary on all the exciting episodes that transpired in the book of Esther. Now, this is very different from what may be called fatalism. That's an impersonal force of circumstance, which is the direct opposite of the providence of a personal God of all wisdom and foreknowledge. So the events in the book of Esther are providential. They are not circumstantial. They are controlled, engineered, and ordered by God, and not by man or by chance. It is not a matter of being in the right place at the right time, as people sometimes say from a human standpoint. It's not due to luck or coincidence, but it's being in God's place at God's time. It's about being in God's will and living according to God's will. It's God who opens and shuts the doors of destiny in life. Just as the Lord said to the church in Philadelphia in Revelation chapter 3, verse 7, "These things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts and no one opens." And we shall see this amply and vividly demonstrated in the events recorded in the book of Esther. So that's the providential setting from God's viewpoint. Next, let's go on to the political setting. The book of Esther is the last of the historical books in the Old Testament, just before the collection of poetical books beginning with Job. It's part of a trilogy of short historical books, including Ezra and Nehemiah. And this trilogy of books deal with the immediate post-exilic history of the returned remnant after the Babylonian exile. After 70 years of dispersion and exile, the return of God's people to the land of Israel took place as had been prophesied. This took place in three cohorts, which were led by, firstly, Zerubbabel the governor, who led them to rebuild the temple. This is recorded in the book of Ezra from chapters 1 through to 6. And the period in which this occurred is from 538 BC to 515 BC. The second cohort was led by Ezra, who was the priest, in 457 BC, and he led in the rebuilding of the spiritual condition of the people. And the record is given in the rest of the chapters in the book of Ezra from chapters 7 through to 10. The third cohort was led by Nehemiah the governor, who led them to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. And the account of that is given in the whole book of Nehemiah. The events in the book of Esther can be placed during the 58-year period between the first cohort and the second cohort. So in chronological sequence, it would lie between Ezra chapters 6 and 7. The events recorded in Esther covered a period of some 10 years, from 483 BC to 473 BC. So if you just step back and take a macro view of both spiritual and secular history, we shall see that God was working simultaneously for His people, both among the returned remnant at home in Israel, as well as among those who were still dispersed abroad under the Medo-Persian Empire. The book opens in verse 1 of chapter 1. "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus." This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces, from India to Ethiopia. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew name for the Persian king ruling at that time, or Xerxes I, which is the Greek name. Xerxes I, of course, is a well-known Persian king in secular history, who reigned from 485 BC to around 465 BC. Verse 2, "In those days when King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel, or sometimes also called Susa the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all." If this were a movie or a play or a musical, this would be the grand opening scene. This was the third year of the king's reign, and there was a grand six-month celebration with a whole string of activities throughout these 180 days. And it culminated in a seven-day feast in the court garden of the palace. Reading on in verse 5, "When these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace." So it was like a great big open house for all the citizens. There was an air of festivity and a holiday mood there. Verse 6, there were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars. It was all a very grand affair. They served drinks in golden vessels, and each vessel was different from the other. There was royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. They also had quite benign and sober laws, as recorded in verse 8. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So while there was a lot of revelry and celebration going on, it wasn't as disorderly or unrestrained as we might have thought, as the people were free to choose not to drink if they so.
Oh, how great are God's riches and wisdom and knowledge. Welcome, everyone. I'm McDaniel Phillips, and this is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. And our host is author, teacher, and itinerant speaker, Kenneth Wong. Well, today, Ken begins a series on one of my most favorite portions of the Old Testament. And although God's name is not mentioned throughout the entire book of Esther, His sovereignty is unmistakable. And so the Apostle Paul proclaims to the church in Rome, "Oh, how great are God's riches and wisdom and knowledge! How impossible it is for us to understand His decisions and His ways!" In just a moment, Ken presents to us part one of The Sovereign Hand of God.
Hello, everyone. I trust you have had a good weekend, and welcome back to Times of Refreshing as we start a most fascinating study of the book of Esther in the Old Testament. This is a Bible book that makes for a most fascinating reading. It's full of intrigue and conspiracy. There is suspense and surprise. In fact, some people might think of it as the perfect material for a bestseller book or a box office hit movie or even a blockbuster TV serial. But this is not a fairy tale. It's a historical happening that is recorded in the Bible. So if you've been finding your Bible reading just a little bit dry and doctrinal maybe for this time, I would suggest that you try reading this book for a change. The major theme of this book is God's hand versus human hands at work behind the scenes. By bringing us behind the scenes, as it were, and seeing things from God's perspective, we can see God's invisible an unseen but sovereign and providential hand at work for those who love Him and know Him, which is what the Apostle Paul says in the well-loved verse of Romans 8:28. "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose." And we see this wonderfully demonstrated not just once but time and again throughout the book of Esther. And so I have entitled this series of studies on the book of Esther, The Sovereign Hand, which is, of course, unmistakably the sovereign hand of God. And we see God's providential and sovereign hand unmistakably manifested throughout the book, even though God is amazingly never named or mentioned or even referred to directly in the whole book. And that can be how it is in life for those who do not know God. Things may seem to happen by chance, by coincidence, or in apparent randomness, when all the time God is in full control. We're going to open our studies by considering three settings, and the right place to begin would be from God's perspective, and we shall call this the providential setting. And secondly, it's the political setting, and that is from man's perspective. And thirdly, it's the personal setting, and that's from Esther's personal perspective as the key character in this whole book, after whom it is named. So let's first look at the providential setting. This is a powerful portrayal of what is sometimes called providence. That means it's God's provision according to His purpose. We see the sovereign hand of God weaving a wonderful tapestry in history. As is sometimes put, history is really His story. Men may seem to rule, but God overrules. God is really the one in absolute control. He's the one who oversees, overrules, and overturns the affairs of men, whenever and wherever He so chooses. Sometimes he does it in ways that are past finding out. They are inscrutable to us. As it says in Romans 11:33, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out." That's a very apt commentary on all the exciting episodes that transpired in the book of Esther. Now, this is very different from what may be called fatalism. That's an impersonal force of circumstance, which is the direct opposite of the providence of a personal God of all wisdom and foreknowledge. So the events in the book of Esther are providential. They are not circumstantial. They are controlled, engineered, and ordered by God, and not by man or by chance. It is not a matter of being in the right place at the right time, as people sometimes say from a human standpoint. It's not due to luck or coincidence, but it's being in God's place at God's time. It's about being in God's will and living according to God's will. It's God who opens and shuts the doors of destiny in life. Just as the Lord said to the church in Philadelphia in Revelation chapter 3, verse 7, "These things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts and no one opens." And we shall see this amply and vividly demonstrated in the events recorded in the book of Esther. So that's the providential setting from God's viewpoint. Next, let's go on to the political setting. The book of Esther is the last of the historical books in the Old Testament, just before the collection of poetical books beginning with Job. It's part of a trilogy of short historical books, including Ezra and Nehemiah. And this trilogy of books deal with the immediate post-exilic history of the returned remnant after the Babylonian exile. After 70 years of dispersion and exile, the return of God's people to the land of Israel took place as had been prophesied. This took place in three cohorts, which were led by, firstly, Zerubbabel the governor, who led them to rebuild the temple. This is recorded in the book of Ezra from chapters 1 through to 6. And the period in which this occurred is from 538 BC to 515 BC. The second cohort was led by Ezra, who was the priest, in 457 BC, and he led in the rebuilding of the spiritual condition of the people. And the record is given in the rest of the chapters in the book of Ezra from chapters 7 through to 10. The third cohort was led by Nehemiah the governor, who led them to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. And the account of that is given in the whole book of Nehemiah. The events in the book of Esther can be placed during the 58-year period between the first cohort and the second cohort. So in chronological sequence, it would lie between Ezra chapters 6 and 7. The events recorded in Esther covered a period of some 10 years, from 483 BC to 473 BC. So if you just step back and take a macro view of both spiritual and secular history, we shall see that God was working simultaneously for his people, both among the returned remnant at home in Israel, as well as among those who were still dispersed abroad under the Medo-Persian Empire. The book opens in verse 1 of chapter 1. "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus." This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces, from India to Ethiopia. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew name for the Persian king ruling at that time, or Xerxes I, which is the Greek name. Xerxes I, of course, is a well-known Persian king in secular history, who reigned from 485 BC to around 465 BC. Verse 2, "In those days when King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the citadel, or sometimes also called Susa the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of His excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. If this were a movie or a play or a musical, this would be the grand opening scene. This was the third year of the king's reign, and there was a grand six-month celebration with a whole string of activities throughout these 180 days. And it culminated in a seven-day feast in the court garden of the palace. Reading on in verse 5, when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So it was like a great big open house for all the citizens. There was an air of festivity and a holiday mood there. Verse 6, there were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars. It was all a very grand affair. They served drinks in golden vessels, and each vessel was different from the other. There was royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. They also had quite benign and sober laws, as recorded in verse 8. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So while there was a lot of revelry and celebration going on, it wasn't as disorderly or unrestrained as we might have thought, as the people were free to choose not to drink if they so wish. At the same time, there was a parallel feast which was hosted by Queen Vashti for the women in the royal house. In verse 9, Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. It is known from history that King Xerxes I went on a military campaign against Greece, where his fleet was disastrously defeated at the famous Battle of Salamis in 480 BC. And this feast was probably in preparation for this big expedition against Greece. But there was a great anticlimax on the very last day at the height of this royal revelry. Verse 10, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded his seven eunuchs or servants who served in the presence of the king to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. Verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Queen Vashti committed the unthinkable folly of insubordination in refusing to appear at the king's bidding. This was something that was never done, especially on such a high-profile event like that day, before all the people, the officials, and the princes. We are not told exactly why she did that. Perhaps she was too busy and carried away with hosting her own feast amongst the women, or even got a little tipsy from drinking so that her judgment was clouded. Be that as it may, this became the trigger event for all the rest of the exciting events that transpired in the book of Esther. Needless to say, the king's fury and wrath was to be expected. So he consulted his wise men, his counselors and advisers as to what action to take. In verse 15, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law, because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus, brought to her by the eunuchs? Once again, we see some evidence of a more orderly and principled dealing with matters according to the law. We can well imagine if a tyrant or a despot was on the throne, it could well have resulted with an immediate execution. This was the advice given by the king's counselors. They said that the queen had not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of the kingdom, because her behavior will become known to all women so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. When the word gets round to their ears that the king commanded the queen to be brought in before him and she disobeyed, and thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath. Their recommendation in verse 19 was this: if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. So this led to the decision and the decree to dethrone the queen as a reminder for all wives in the kingdom to honor their husbands, as well as for all men to bear rule properly in their own house. We read in verse 21 that the reply pleased the king and the princes. And so the king did according to all that was recommended. Verse 22, then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. All this is actually quite scriptural, as we read in the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. And then in verse 25, for the husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. But the spiritual reality of this ideal is that it can only be truly fulfilled in the Lord. It comes through mutual love and submission in the Lord, and not by coercion. So the first chapter ends with this incident, which is but the first of many sudden and unexpected turns of events throughout the book. But it's the trigger event for the rest of the story. Thirdly, we come to the personal setting, from the personal perspective of Esther as the key character of the book. Chapter 2 opens with this scene. When the dust had settled and the anger of the king had subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her, in verse 1. In verses 2 to 4, the king's servant suggested that beautiful young virgins be sought for the king throughout the provinces of the empire. They would be brought to the capital city of Shushan and given a very thorough course of beauty treatment and preparations. Verse 4, then the young woman who pleases the king will be queen instead of Vashti. And this thing pleased the king, and he did so. This suggestion and development brought another train of events which eventually led to the selection and elevation of Esther as queen. But let's not jump too far ahead. More of that later. Meanwhile, we are focusing on the personal setting. Who was Esther and what was her background? We are first introduced to her in Esther chapter 2, verses 5 through to 7. We are first introduced to her guardian, a man called Mordecai of the tribe of Benjamin, among the Hebrew exiles who lived in Shushan, the citadel. Esther, who is the key character in this book, is first introduced and comes on the scene in chapter 2, verse 7. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So what we learn from these verses is that Esther was one of thousands of young Hebrew women in the captivity. She was born there in a foreign land, but she was bred with godly upbringing. She was also a young orphan who was adopted and raised by her relative Mordecai. We are told both in verses 7 and 15 that Esther was the daughter of Abihail, who was the uncle of Mordecai, which makes Mordecai an older cousin of Esther's. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah, and her Persian name was Esther, meaning star, which also became a popular Greek and Latin name. Esther was endowed with both physical beauty as well as a beautiful spirit, which is surely a rare but winning combination. She is described in verse 7 as lovely and beautiful, and this must surely include an inner grace and a sweet disposition, matched with a quiet strength of character. No doubt, it must have been this inner beauty and spiritual quality that was the X factor that distinguished her from the hundreds of other candidates who must have been chosen firstly for their physical beauty. Reading on from verse 8 of Esther chapter 2. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Verse 9, Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. And so, with a very sudden and quick turn of events, triggered by the powers that be in the imperial court, this lowly orphaned girl, who was both godly and beautiful, suddenly found her quiet life drawn into the wake of events which echoed throughout the empire. Our closing scene for this episode finds Esther among the shortlisted hopefuls for the next queen, enjoying the favor of both God and man. As we continue the exciting episodes in the book of Esther, may you continue to be refreshed by God's presence and reached by His word.
Wives, submit to your husbands as unto the Lord. Queen Vashti learned an important principle, albeit too late. But in God's providence, her insubordination made way for the emergence of Queen Esther. Thank you, Kenneth. This is Times of Refreshing, a ministry of Bethesda Hall in partnership with TWR Asia. And I invite you to join us again tomorrow when Kenneth brings us part 2 of The Sovereign Hand of God. Right now, though, we would love to hear from you, and I have several ways through which you can be in contact. You can send us a text message at 9431-3813, or you can write to us at Post Office Box 392, Thompson Road Post Office, Singapore 915-714. You can go to our Facebook page and leave your comments there or share some views with some of the other folks you see. Also, I invite you to visit our website, www.timesofrefreshing.asia, where you can listen to the program right online. And Times of Refreshing has launched an iPhone app that allows users to directly access the broadcast messages and the podcasts right from their iPhones. I'm McDaniel Phillips, inviting you to join us again for Times of Refreshing.